download past shows, or get them updated automatically. Just type Progressive Radio Network in the search bar and download any show free of charge. Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
That's jazz pianist Randy Weston with J.K. Blues, a collaboration with composer-arranger Melba Liston. And that name should sound familiar to you if you're a fan of the trombone. Melba Liston, famous for her trombone skills. Teddy Edwards on tenor sax and Jamil Nasser on bass. It's from Weston's 1993 album, Volcano Blues, although this piece was written all the way back in the 50s, actually, and revived for this particular album. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today we are going to have with us an extraordinary academician, a brainiac, a historian, a person who has been with us many times, decoding for us the complex issues of the day, particularly from a historical perspective, but not exclusively so. Historian and prolific author Gerald Horn looks at a few contemporary issues with us today through the lens of history, and his lens is a particularly different kind of lens. Horn, the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's chair of the History and African American Studies Department at the University of Houston, has written more than 30 books and 100 scholarly papers on global struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. In the last couple of years alone, he has written several books, including the most recent one, Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary, that came out last year, Confronting Black Jacobins, The U.S., The Haitian Revolution, and The Origins of the Dominican Republic, which was published in 2015, Race to Revolution, The U.S. and Cuba during Slavery, and Jim Crow in 2014, and also in 2014, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance, and the Origins of the United States of America. I must tell you this. This is one historian whose books ought to be in your library. If you don't yet have a library, he is one great place to start. His books are always draw rave reviews, especially from historians. He looks at the corners of history that are routinely ignored or not fully reported on. And so I would say that Gerald Horne is one of the historians who retrieves for us, especially African Americans, but for all people, because his books are for all people, the missing pages of history. Gerald, it's great to have you with us. It's been a while, because I suspect you're probably in libraries everywhere doing more research for your new books. Thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's start right there. What are you working on now?
Well, first of all, a footnote. As we speak, there is an online roundtable on my work at the site of the African American Intellectual History Society. That's aaihs.org. And perhaps if one takes a break from this network, one can go to that site, aaihs.org. But in any case, I have a book on the Black press coming out in a few weeks, and then a few weeks after that, I have a book coming out on Afro-Asian solidarity with a focus on Japan before 1945, before the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And then I have a book on aviation, Black people in aviation, coming out right after that. And then a study of the origins of slavery, white supremacy, and capitalism in North America and the Caribbean in the 17th century, which will come out within the next 5 to 6 months. And then I'm going to be starting to write a study of U.S. imperialism in Southern Africa from the 19th century up until the democratic elections in South Africa in 1994. And then, given your musical taste, you might be interested in this book I'll be probably writing next year on the political economy of jazz.
Oh, wow. So you're not busy at all.
Well, that's one way to put it.
It's so good to have you on. We haven't talked really since Donald Trump took office. In the first quarter of his tenure, what are you making of it as a historian?
Well, I'm glad you asked me to speak about it as a historian, because I was about to immediately go to this Russia issue. But speaking as a historian, I think that the Trump election in many ways represents a crisis for both U.S. imperialism and white supremacy. It's a direct outgrowth of the previous epoch, that is to say the Cold War, whereby Washington felt compelled to destabilize trade unions in particular, and left-led trade unions more specifically. I'm thinking of, for example, the National Maritime Union, once led by the Jamaican immigrant, Ferdinand Smith, who then was deported in the late 1940s as the union leadership was routed. I'm thinking of the West Coast longshoremen under the leadership of the Australian emigre Harry Bridges, who, of course, was in and out of court repeatedly and managed to hold on. But certainly the kinds of unions that he represented suffered very staggering and weakening blows. And I think that the weakening of unions had a particularly damaging impact, not only on the working class, not only on the Black working class, which, of course, at the same time was receiving anti-Jim Crow concessions, but as the saying goes, what it meant was you had a right to check into a hotel, but because of the weakening of unions, this working class population did not have the money to pay the bill. But at least you could say for the Black community, even though this community was weakened by the weakening of trade unions, they still had many community organizations to rest upon, even though these organizations too were weakened. I'm thinking of the Black press, the NAACP, the Nation of Islam, the churches, etc. But I think it had a particularly devastating impact on the Euro-American working class, which is one partial explanation for why Donald J. Trump did so well in the so-called Rust Belt, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, setting aside the errors and blunders of his major opponent, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. And so, therefore, this rise of Trump in many ways is a direct outgrowth of the previous epoch. But what this rise of Trump is revealing is that Washington, U.S. imperialism, is really not up to the task of dealing with the present conjuncture. You see that with regard to the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord, which has caused outrage amongst its so-called allies in the North Atlantic bloc. His repeated insults to Germany's Chancellor Merkel, which is causing Germany to pull back from its alliance with Washington. All of this is creating enormous opportunities, as the mainstream press even has noted, for China. And of course, the rise of China in many ways is too is a direct outgrowth of the Cold War, because in order to destabilize the Soviet Union, China was won over with concessions, beginning with Richard Nixon's trip there some four odd decades ago. And Washington did not contemplate at the time that it was helping to lay the groundwork for this major superpower, to the point now where I'm now reading this book by Harvard's Graham Allison, Destined for War, Can America and China Escape the Thucydides Trap, which is to say, can they escape the prospect of war in coming years? So this is part of the crisis that the Donald J. Trump administration has delivered, but it would be a mistake, as many friends on the left do, to just focus on Donald J. Trump as an individual, although I'm all for battering him from pillar to post. I'm all for removing him from office, in fact. But if we don't look at the underlying currents, then I think we'll miss the boat, and it'll just set us up for Trumpism even after Trump is removed.
But in the world of politics, people don't think very much in long range. It's what works for the immediate future. Right now, what will get them over the hump? How do you see parties, political parties, functioning in some way to ameliorate the situation? Because we have what I call a rogue president, a very uninformed president, surrounded by people who also are uninformed. But in the breach, one would have expected that the Democratic Party, well, this would be their shining hour, or the Green Party, or other movements, Sanders. But it seems also, and even the union movements. But they don't seem to be as energized as they should be.
Well, I think that many of those parties and unions that we have in mind, as I've suggested, have been weakened tremendously because of what they were put through during the previous epoch, meaning the Cold War and the Red Scare. And it's unclear if they'll be able to recover. Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, just made the statement a few days ago that as he sees it, Donald J. Trump, despite our attack on him and our comrades' attack on him, will be reelected in 2020. And many respected academics actually agree with Donald J. Trump. It's apparent that these attacks on him, particularly on the Russia front, have not eroded his support amongst his core supporters, amongst his base supporters, who see in some ways an attack on Trump as an attack on themselves, and also as a result of the polarization and the tribalism that has infected politics in the United States. If those like yourself or myself attack Trump and attack his position, for example, on climate change, they feel duty bound to come to Trump's defense and defend Trump. Now, you mentioned the short-term approach of many in this country in the preface to your comment and question. And what that reminded me of, I just sent off to the publisher the final version of my book on Afro-Asian solidarity and the rise of Japan. And the last sentence in the book is quoting these two black academics who are now no longer with us, Hugh Smith and his spouse. And they spent time in Japan in the early 1950s, and their comment was that even though Japan was now down on its knees after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They took the long-term view in Tokyo. That is to say that they took the 2,600-year point of view, and they perhaps saw this defeat in World War II as a temporary setback and just the platform which could be launched a turnaround. And in the United States, as you know, on Wall Street, there's this short-termism. That is to say, a CEO is turned out of his office if the profits for the current quarter do not reach a certain limit. Interestingly enough, Amazon.com, whose major shareholder is Jeff Bezos, who, by the way, controls the Washington Post, which has been on the forefront of the attacks on Trump. Trump, by the way, in 2016 suggested that Amazon.com under a Trump administration should be subjected to antitrust litigation, that is to say broken up, which of course was not good news for Jeff Bezos, who's in the fast track to becoming the richest man on planet Earth, surpassing Bill Gates. And it's interesting that Bezos, every year in his shareholder letter, says that he's not going to be a captive to short-termism. And of course, Amazon, for the first few years of its operation, really wasn't churning out profits because they were turning revenue back into building up the operation. I think that in order to understand the alienation between Trump and the mass media, you should look at the Washington Post in the first place, look at Jeff Bezos in the second place. But unfortunately, in terms of all of this 24/7 coverage of Donald J. Trump, that particular factoid somehow has lost, has not been focused on.
What is interesting is that in the last 4 months, maybe a little longer than that, but certainly in the last 4 months, we're seeing something of a realignment of interests. I don't know whether it's genuine or whether it's just a matter of pragmatism, but a realigning of global interests. They seem to be taking a hard look at ways in which they could benefit from cooperation, even though we just saw today that in the Far East, in the Middle East, I should say, you have Qatar being pilloried again, and the Arab nations are fracturing and splitting up again. But how are you reading the way global forces are operating since Trump? I'm not suggesting, by the way, that Trump caused it, but he certainly is a factor.
He certainly is a factor. And I think from the point of view of the U.S. ruling elite, what Trump initially was attempting to do with regard to a detente with Moscow made sense, because obviously China is in the passing lane. And just as 4 decades ago, Nixon started leaning towards China in order to bring down the Soviet Union, that tactic worked. It made sense from the point of view of the U.S. ruling elite to then reverse that tactic and lean towards Russia in order to put pressure on China. But, of course, with this ham-fisted, amateurish approach, Mr. Trump, rather than going through a National Security Council review and going through papers and having conferences and think tanks, was just randomly sending out tweets, randomly
calling. He's a tweeter man.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was a very ham-fisted approach. And this, at the same time, was angering a certain wing of the U.S. ruling elite, which is totally invested, number one, in this project of liberal interventionism, which Hillary Rodham Clinton represented. Mr. Trump, in some ways, reassured them in April 2017 when he launched that cruise missile attack on Syria, but he didn't follow up. He hasn't followed up. There is also a wing of the U.S. ruling elite which is heavily invested in an anti-Moscow psychosis. They are terribly upset by his apparent overtures to Moscow. Reference here the fact that there is a credible analysis that suggests that other than his crimes, I'm speaking of Richard M. Nixon, his crimes in terms of trying to turn the IRS and the FBI and the CIA into wings of his reelection campaign to destabilize his opponents. But there's also an argument that there was a wing of the U.S. ruling elite which was upset with his foreign policy, not least his detente policy with Moscow, and that helped unleash the dogs against him. And so to that extent, you can see a parallel, not only with regard to Watergate comparison with Trumpgate, but also with Russia being at the center. So part of what's happening, of course, is this turmoil engendered in the international community by the rise of China. The U.S. share of global income is shrinking, which is putting added pressure on the United States, not necessarily the U.S. ruling elite, which is still doing quite well, thank you very much, but certainly it's putting pressure upon certain sectors of the Euro-American population. And this Euro-American population, despite what liberal historians have tried to tell us, from their point of view, the way the U.S. was built was by expropriating Native Americans and taking their land and parceling it out to poor Euro-Americans just off the boat, and then stocking that land with enslaved Africans. And quite frankly, some historians have begun to agree with that particular approach, and perhaps we can get to that later. But in any case, what happened in the 20th century was that under international pressure, the United States had to retreat from the more egregious aspects of U.S. apartheid and Jim Crow, which in some ways helped to unleash a sector of the black working class into competition with this reigning Euro-American working class and Euro-American middle class. And then after the China deal engineered by Nixon, then Asian workers were unleashed against Euro-American workers as U.S. corporations began to move their plants to China and to Asia generally, basically whipsawing that Euro-American working class. And so when Trump came along and said, make America great again, the dog whistle, perhaps the wolf whistle that was heard, perhaps the megaphone blast that was heard, was that the clock would be turned back. Now, I think it may be too late in the game to turn the clock all the way back, but I've been wrong before. And as you look at these crimes of racial hate that have been proliferating lately in New York City with the man from Maryland coming up to Manhattan and stabbing a black man randomly on the street, in terms of College Park, Maryland, where a black student just a few days ago was stabbed by an ultra-rightist, or what happened on the train in Portland with regard to an ultra-rightist stabbing two men who had interfered in his harassing of two young black women, one of whom was wearing a hijab, the Muslim headdress. If you look at the racial epithet scrawled on the mansion of basketball star LeBron James in an exclusive West Los Angeles neighborhood, if you look at the nooses that were found at the National African American History and Culture Museum in Washington, D.C., well, then you begin to think that perhaps there will be this concerted attack to turn back the clock. And if you look at the state of black organizations in particular, which are not necessarily, I don't believe, really up to the task. Now, for example, just a few days ago, on interestingly enough, on the birthday of Malcolm X, May 19th, 2017, the NAACP board sacked its leader, Cornell Brooks, supposedly because he was not able to keep pace with the gathering anti-Trump resistance. But if you look at the NAACP and take the longer view and look at the fact that in the late 1940s, they were forced to purge left-wingers from their ranks, including their founder, W.E.B. Du Bois. In the 1960s, they were forced to distance themselves from black nationalists like Malcolm X. So to the point now where the NAACP base has shrunk, and so rather than firing its chief executives, which they keep doing, before Mr. Brooks, there was Ben Jealous, and there was Ben Chavis, and there was Kwesi Mfume. Obviously, the NAACP board needs to reexamine its political line in light of current events. But what happened when they started purging people like Du Bois and ignoring people like Paul Robeson is that they basically became tacticians and don't have a strategy, because in order to have a strategy, you have to begin with the international situation and then work your way back from there. And that kind of approach is frankly alien, I'm afraid, to many in this country.
But the NAACP, from its early beginnings, had been pegged as an organization that really was more for the purpose of controlling black anger, and in some cases even controlling black progress, ironically, rather than confronting the system. It was deemed as an extension of the system with a black face.
Well, I think it's had ups and downs. I mean, certainly if you look at the origins of the organization in 1909, it was an organization of the left. It was an organization founded by socialists and black leftists, and that was not that difficult then, given the fact that the mountain that this organization had to climb was so steep that they felt that they had little choice but to ally with those on the left. But beginning in the 1940s, when these anti-Jim Crow concessions were dangled before the NAACP, but in return they had to purge themselves of these folks on the left, they accepted that Faustian bargain, and that has been the case for 75-odd years or 70-odd years or more. Interestingly enough, now, if you look at the journals of opinion of the liberal interventionist elite, they're beginning to talk about a crack-up of the North Atlantic Alliance, which in many ways was a product of that same kind of mindset, that is to say, a sort of anti-communist mindset. And now, 25 years or more after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the collapse of the socialist camp, there is this nagging recognition that this North Atlantic Alliance, which has NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, as a centerpiece, no longer makes sense. I mean, that's part of what Trump is trying to say, because in many ways, NATO, which came into existence to confront the Soviet Union, has not been able to rethink its mission in light of the collapse of the Soviet Union, in light of the collapse of the North Atlantic nations. Mr. Trump argues that the United States is basically Uncle Sucker, not Uncle Sam, because it suffers and endures, says Mr. Trump, this yawning trade deficit with Germany, a country of 82 million, which by per capita analysis is the most significant trading nation on planet Earth. And, of course, if you look out your window and you see the Mercedes and BMWs and the Volkswagens tooling down the boulevard, you'll get an idea of what I'm talking about. Now, of course, Chancellor Merkel comes back and says, well, yeah, you know, many of those cars are made in South Carolina, but the bulk of the profit is still returning across the ocean to Stuttgart and Cologne and Munich and Berlin. It's very interesting that at the same time you have this crisis in NAACP, you have a similar crisis in the North Atlantic relationship, and I do believe that those two are not unconnected.
Well, yes, the Volkswagens are made in North Carolina, but there's been a months-long protest going on over low wages, and it primarily affects the black workers. They're the ones who have been bearing the brunt of the low wages at that plant. So I come back to the NAACP with its internal contradiction of race or colorism. It certainly had a problem there. I mean, you had people like Marcus Garvey being called a monkey. You know, you had the dark people, the dark-skinned intellectuals marginalized by the lighter-skinned intellectuals. So you have this. Problem spilling over into the focus of the NAACP, because I would argue that the darker skinned members of the NAACP, first of all, they objected strenuously the issue of race, very, very strong. They objected strenuously to the idea that it was called the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and the focus was diluted, in their view, to include a lot of people who were not nearly in such desperate situations as blacks in the United States. The radicals said we have to pay attention to race and class. And so there came to be a split within the NAACP, which continues to this day.
Yeah, I know that's a familiar argument, but look, I mean, if you look at black Americans generally, not just NAACP, an objective observer would not find it coincidental that if you look at the melanin content of Adam Clayton Powell, the late congressman from Harlem, or Julian Bond, the state senator from Atlanta, or Louis Farrakhan, the head of the Nation of Islam, or Elijah Muhammad, the former head of the Nation of Islam, you know, their melanin content was not the significance. So I'm not sure if all that should be laid at the doorstep of the NAACP, point number one. Point number two, there were many conflicts and concordance between these people who supposedly were each other's throats. I mean, if you take Du Bois and Garvey, for example, and those are the two figures who are usually trotted out when you talk about this conflict between the NAACP and the UNIA. But in fact, there's another split, which I'm talking about in my next book, which somehow has escaped attention, which is that Du Bois and Garvey and Booker T. Washington, for that matter, despite the conflicts between and amongst them, all were pro-Tokyo, whereas you had all of these other intellectuals of varying hues, be they Langston Hughes or Paul Robeson or other leaders whose names have now been lost to history. They were not pro-Tokyo, and they were always excoriating Du Bois and Garvey and Booker T. Washington for being pro-Tokyo. And this was not a minor issue because Japan and the States were in a shooting war that culminated with the use of atomic weapons. So I'm not sure if I'm willing to go along with the usual analysis of, you know, colorism, NAACP versus Garvey and all that. There are many contradictions that somehow have been lost to history.
I agree with that. However, I still think when you mention people like Adam Clayton Powell and so forth, these people developed and were very, very outspoken about where they stood in terms of being on the side of the oppressed. They didn't have any kind of conflict around that. They knew where they stood. But within the NAACP, you saw so many ugly instances where the organization appeared to have fallen into a trap of being split apart by small things introduced by members of the NAACP leadership who successfully, in my view, diverted the attention of the organization away from vigorous support of popular movements, instead came to these small fights, which underscored this problem that African Americans had been having for a long time: who was more valuable, who was more worthy based on the color of their skin. So,
well, you know,
I hear you.
Once again, I would not lay that solely at the doorstep of the NAACP. As I was trying to suggest, that's a problem of black people in the United States in general, a legacy of slavery, not only in North America, but a legacy of slavery in Jamaica and in Trinidad and other places.
Sure.
The lighter you were, the more entitled you were to leadership. So just trying to act like that's the NAACP problem, I think, is a bridge too far. Second, Adam Clayton Powell, the former congressman from Harlem. Now, Adam Clayton Powell somehow turned up at the Bandung Conference of 1955 in Indonesia, which was the beginning of the rise of the non-aligned movement and decolonization in Africa and Asia. Now, Du Bois, Robeson, et cetera, were not given passports to go to Bandung. And, of course, Adam Clayton Powell, when he got to Bandung, was defending Uncle Sam. So, you know, I would go further to say that in terms of your previous point with regard to colored people, well, at the time of the founding of the NAACP, there was the stirrings in Mexico. As I said in my book, Black and Brown, African Americans and the Mexican Revolution, some of the most radical initiatives that came out of Black America came 100 years ago at the time of the Mexican Revolution, when there was an attempt by Mexican revolutionaries and Black Americans and Native Americans to take back the land that had been seized from Mexico in the War of Aggression, 1846 to 1848, liquidate the Euro-American population, and establish instead independent Black and Native American republics. Once again, that kind of history has been lost in the midst of amnesia. And instead, once again, you have this idea of people of color somehow is a sellout idea, when actually the most radical ideas were coming out of that context. See, sometimes I feel that all my labor.
I did a program on that in conjunction with Cinco de Mayo, explaining how the Mexicans and African Americans really connected and were connected in revolutionary war, if you will. I want to come back to the issue that you raised about the rearrangement of global forces. Is it ironic that we see an attempt to come together in some things, but still the prospect of war is at the center of it all, still?
Well, it's interesting. I neglected to respond to your point about Qatar. That's a very important point. This is the small Gulf nation that is part of the Gulf Cooperation Council. It has the most significant per capita income on planet Earth today, about $130,000 per individual. And of course, they rely upon a lot of imported cheap labor from the Philippines and India. But still, it's a major exporter of liquefied natural gas. Of course, Al Jazeera, the TV network, comes out of Qatar. Now, as you suggested, the Saudis and the Egyptians in particular have just slapped an air embargo and a sea embargo on this small nation, whose population is only a few hundred thousand, even though it's quite wealthy on a per capita basis. I suspect that this is a direct outgrowth of the trip to Saudi Arabia by the U.S. President Donald J. Trump, and that helped to embolden the Saudis to crack down on the Qataris. They're upset with the Qataris because the Qataris did not support the overthrow of Mohamed Morsi in Cairo, Egypt. The Qataris are very close to the Muslim Brotherhood. The Saudis, of course, supported the overthrow. Of course, General al-Sisi in Cairo, obviously he's upset with the Qataris because they're supporting Mohamed Morsi to this very day. But I suspect that what will happen is that the Qataris will basically engage in a self-fulfilling prophecy. That is to say, that one of the bones of contention against the Qataris is that they've been not as hostile to Iran as the Saudis would like them to be. The Saudis, despite their preening on the international stage and the fact that supposedly is a stable country, has been sucked into a quagmire of war in Yemen, which is draining the treasury. There are some who suspect that unless the barrel of oil goes up to $80, right now it's $50, the Saudis are really going to be suffering tremendously in coming months. And I think that might help to explain this attack on the Qataris, because the Qataris, even though they house a U.S. military facility, it's a very small nation that flexes its muscles tremendously on the international scene. And if you're in a country like Saudi Arabia, which is leaking capital, it seems like too luscious an opportunity to pass up than to try to take over Qatari, which of course would lead to war. In that context, it's striking that the Iranians have now come to the assistance of the Qataris, offering to supply them with food, because a lot of the Qatari food have been coming across a land border with Saudi Arabia. This would be by sea from Iran. And this, if it happens, drawing Qataris closer to the Iranians, will inflame the Saudis and Egyptians even further, which could bring conflict even closer. Now, the question is, what does the United States do in that situation? The United States, as I said, has a military base in Qatar. Supposedly, they have sound relations with Qatar. But on the other hand, if Qataris ally with Iran, which the United States is sworn to destabilize, well, it seems to me that we have the beginnings of a major conflict. And by the way, such a major conflict would deflect the United States from what some of the ruling elites think should be its long-term ambition, which is to confront China, which is now in the passing lane.
Well, it also will involve Israel and a vowed enemy of Iran. And Iran seems to be the favorite target these days. Everybody's talking about how evil it is and why it ought to be destroyed.
Well, it's interesting. In the Wall Street Journal today, there's a full-page ad from all 50 U.S. governors plus the mayor of the District of Columbia opposing the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel. The timing is not coincidental since it comes on the cusp of the 50th anniversary of the so-called Six-Day War of 1967, which had led to the Israelis gobbling up a Palestinian territory, which they still control and seemingly have no intention of ever relinquishing. Certainly, the Israelis, from their point of view, they feel that they're sitting pretty. I mean, they have Donald J. Trump in the White House. It's no secret that despite President Obama bending over backwards, including a massive arms transfers to Israel, they were happy to see him go. But I dare say that the Israelis may be a bit premature in terms of their giving high fives and engaging in self-congratulation, because this rise of China is going to have significant impact on the global correlation of forces, which inevitably will impact Israel. And I'm sure their foreign ministry is thinking about that as we speak, which is one of the reasons why you've had credible reports about U.S. military technology, the most sophisticated variety, actually leaking out to China. And, of course, Mr. Netanyahu not only has tried to maintain good relationships with China, but he's also tried to maintain good relationships with India, another rising power. And, of course, the fact that there's a certain amount of Islamophobia in Delhi right now helps to facilitate that relationship. And, of course, Mr. Netanyahu, according to some analysts, has better relations with Moscow than it does with Washington. I think that may be an exaggeration, but it does give a hint of what I'm driving at. And what I'm driving at in part, just to take off from that point of with regard to Moscow, is that part of what the 24/7 cable channels are missing and their round-the-clock coverage of Russia and Trump is that the United States, in seeking to isolate Moscow, is going to find a very steep uphill climb, not only because of Russia's close relationships with China, its close relationships with India, which go back to 1947 and Indian independence, but in light of Mr. Trump alienating Germany, it's probably going to force the European Union eventually, sooner rather than later, to back down from sanctions against Russia. Already, Italy has been clamoring for such for months now, ever since they were slapped on in light of the Crimea annexation in 2014. And so I find it very striking in terms of all this Russophobia in the atmosphere right now. There's really not a clear thinking about what this is all leading to, perhaps because these folks are still living in 1953 and they still see the United States as this colossus bestriding the planet. But that position, I'm afraid, is in the process of disintegrating.
Well, speaking of disintegrating, we saw the relationship between the United States and Britain disintegrating even just recently. Britain is, of course, to have its election soon, but the elections are preceded by terror attacks and some rough edges with Washington, as exhibited by in the visit of Trump to Europe, and how alienating he was to the European leaders. Now Britain is on the receiving end of a lot of terrorism. We have had 3 terrorist acts in the last 3 months. In the last month, actually, sorry. What is happening, in your view, to Britain?
Well, what's happening in part is that this is a direct outgrowth of British foreign policy. Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party leader who may become Prime Minister after Thursday's election, has been making that point. He's been saying that there needs to be difficult talks, that's his term, not mine, with the Saudis in particular, because it's no secret that the kind of religious zealotry that has been besetting London of late in some ways is funded, if not directed, by Saudi nationals. It's no coincidence that 15 of the 19 hijackers on September 11, 2001, were Saudi nationals. It's interesting to note as well that the suspect in the Manchester bombing just a few days ago of the Ariana Grande concert was in and out of Libya, apparently having contact with ISIS in Libya. I need not remind your audience that the British and the United States under President Obama overthrew the Gaddafi regime in 2011, and that helped to create an opening for the so-called Islamic State. And as we speak, Libya is beleaguered by the presence of hundreds, if not thousands, of so-called militias, you might even call them gangs, who are plundering the nation and who have also created a kind of sanctuary for Islamic State. Now, Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, was formerly Home Secretary, which means that part of her portfolio was being in charge of who comes in and out of Britain. And apparently on her watch, because of the British relationship with the Saudis, that and this relationship, this dysfunctional relationship with Libya, that folks were going back and forth between that part of the world and London. And it's almost as if the Tory party has decided that the British population is going to be collateral damage in light of pursuing this dysfunctional relationship with the Saudis, who, by the way, once again, are pumping tremendous amounts of capital into Britain, just like they're pumping tremendous amounts of capital into the United States. You might have noticed that when Donald J. Trump was in Saudi Arabia, supposedly this arms deal was inked that amounts to tens of billions of dollars. I've heard figures from $100 billion to $300 billion. And even
before $100 billion immediately, but in all, the total package is said to be about $450 billion.
Which is real money. And even before that, of course, we know that Saudi nationals are major investors in Fox News and Twitter and all the rest. And so there's this tremendously dysfunctional relationship between the North Atlantic countries, particularly London and Washington, and their erstwhile allies in Saudi Arabia. I might make another point, that there has been a lot of talk about the rise of right-wing populism in the North Atlantic bloc, although if you look at the French elections, Ms. Le Pen was defeated. If you look at the Netherlands election, the right-wing populists were defeated. So far, they've been defeated in Austria. And if Jeremy Corbyn does well on Thursday, it'll be possible to say that right-wing populism in the North Atlantic bloc is basically centered in Washington, D.C., and the United States of America in general. Part of the problem here is that in our understandable rush to castigate Trump with all of his multiple flaws and weaknesses, what we haven't done, what many haven't done, is do an analysis of the electorate. I mean, here's one factoid, for example. I mentioned a few moments ago the Portland train stabbing. According to certain press reports, the alt-right or neo-fascists responsible for those slayings supported Donald J. Trump, but before that he supported Bernie Sanders. Now, in terms of trying to calm our frazzled nerves about the election of Donald J. Trump, many of our friends on the left have suggested that many Trump supporters actually supported Bernie Sanders. But they did not go deeply enough, because if this point is accurate with regard to Mr. Christian, which happens to be his name, being a Sanders supporter than a Trump supporter, then there should have been a deeper analysis, which is, why would somebody support Sanders and then support Trump? Does that have anything to do with the fact that historically there has been a right-wing populist trend, a right-wing social democratic trend in the United States of America, which has said that benefits should be doled out exclusively to the melanin deficient, to the Euro-Americans? I mean, if you look at the New Deal, for example, many historians have pointed that out, the many New Deal programs, the only way they were able to get the votes of Jim Crow senators was to deprive black people of New Deal benefits. That's the kind of analysis that we should have had when there was all this loose talk about Sanders supporter. We should be reassured because people who voted for Trump are actually Sanders supporters. But instead, what we got was this kind of happy talk. I think part of the problem in the United States is that people still have this rather mystical belief in this fantasy that in 1776, this great project was launched, albeit with a few flaws, like genocide against Native Americans and enslavement of the Africans. And people are still holding to that belief, even as, to return to a point I mentioned earlier, that even mainstream historians are moving away from that point of view. Let me point you, for example, to the book by Harvard Law School professor Michael Klarman, K-L-A-R-M-A-N, The Framers' Coup, which basically suggests that this vaunted U.S. Constitution, which many liberals salute every time they wake up in the morning, was actually a document that was meant to ratify not only what we already know, which is expropriating the Native Americans and keeping the Africans enslaved, but also to benefit creditors over debtors. And, of course, if you look at the recent books on 1776 by Alan Taylor of the University of Virginia, for example, you'll find that they, too, are inching ever closer to a point of view that, I must humbly say, mirrors mine. But what happens in this country is that people really don't keep up. You know, people feel, well, you know, I got a BA, so, you know, I know everything I need to know. When actually education should be not only a lifetime project, it should be a monthly and a daily project.
Well, you said quite a lot today, as usual, and so much information that we need to. I think these conversations should be revisited. I do it all the time. I revisit, and you learn something more each time. Gerald, I want to thank you so much, both for the work you do and for your generosity in sharing it. As I said from the at the beginning of the program, you're one of the finest that we have, the finest historians, and you are meticulous in researching and putting every bit of energy that you can into making sure that once it's written, I mean, it could be sworn by. So I want to thank you for the quality of your work, of course, and for the rate at which you produce it. I look forward to your next 6 books, and I thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and once again, tune in to aaihs.org for this roundtable on some of the points we've been discussing this afternoon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That brings us to the end of our program today. I know you found it very informative. I certainly did. It always is informative when you talk with Gerald Horn. And we hadn't talked with him in a while. And so he made up for it today. Thank you so much, Gerald. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Meditations and Molotovs with Vincent Emanuele. You want to reach me? Then reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories, at gmail.com. I want to say a word or two. Thank you so much. I received some really wonderful notes from you. I haven't been able to type. It will end soon. It will come to an end in a minute when my hand and arm are patched up. So it's a little, my right hand is my dominant hand. And while I could hunt and peck, I can't hunt and peck fast enough to get all my work done. But that's coming. It's coming very soon. Thanks for being with me today. It's always a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
PRN would like to thank its listeners for making us number one on Zeno.